You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
Hoofstack animals doing that. Like, I know my hoofstack. And I had never heard of the Tibetan antelope. The more I read about them, they're just such a cool creature with an amazing...
What can they teach us?
So they're fast, running in cold temperatures, but also at high elevation. How do they do it? So what... When I'm at 7,000 feet or somewhere else in elevation, I struggle.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
And this is an episode on the Chiryu, or what do we call them?
The Tibetan antelope. Yes, it's... Mm-hmm. Awesome. I'm so happy to be here today talking about this brilliant creature that I never had heard of before until I heard them recently when I watched Apple TV's new Earth Sound series. And recently, I think last episode, I had the awesome privilege to interview the producers, Alex Williamson and Sam Hodgins. And we talked all about this brilliant series about noises that animals and the earth makes. And in the second episode called The Himalayas, this incredible hoofstock animal makes a sound so bellowing, so almost repulsive and loud and just intense. And I had to pause it and rewind it 3 or 4 different times to hear the sound and be like, what hoofstock animal is doing that? Like, I know my hoofstock. And I had never heard of the Tibetan antelope. The more I read about them, they're just such a cool creature with an amazing conservation story. And these Tibetan antelope, they live in one of the most inhospitable, harshest places on earth. High, high, high up in the mountain steppes of the Tibetan plateau, which is one of the reasons why they make loud sounds, so they can broadcast their territory and call for females when the males are in rut. But it was just a very, very moving experience to be able to listen to this, this recording. And the producers, they're some of the first people to record some of these really incredible sounds. And it's a great series. Check it out. My interview's fun with them. I learned a lot in this series, and I learned even more talking with these gentlemen. So it's a brilliant new series by Apple TV. So check it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched it because you told me, like, you got to watch it, Chris. And they called the Tibetan antelope, the males, the world's worst singing contest. So I know we're going to get there later in the podcast. We talk about mating behavior, and this was called the world's strangest antelope. There are so many things about this species. It lives in some of the most extreme high environments, the Himalayas. So how do they survive up there in this oxygen-deprived atmosphere up there? You know, and they can run up to, you know, we'll talk about 50 miles an hour or close to over 70 kilometers per hour. So they book it for miles. They migrate. Yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff to unpack today.
Yeah, it's just, and then it's a hopeful episode in that these Tibetan antelope were almost wiped out due to poaching for their really wool coat. Because they're not a domesticated species like the sheep, they're not sheared and then let go. They're killed and then their wool is collected and it makes these scarves. And it's just a fascinating conservation story because, yeah, they were almost completely wiped out. And there's been a lot of conservation done in that region in Tibet. Kudos to China, India. They're all working together to try to save the species. And it's doing better. The numbers have not, they're not in the millions like it was estimated to be in the 1900s and things like that. But it is, I think I got different numbers, anywhere from 70,000 to 150,000 antelopes, depending on which source we looked at. So their numbers are increasing. Their population is recovering, and there's still some poaching though. So we'll talk about that. But it's a really fun. I'm going to bring it today, Chris. I'm excited.
I know. That's why I was like, I didn't over prepare for this. And we will talk about the good work China's doing. Before we describe it, because it is unique. It is unique looking for antelope. Just a thank you to all of our Patreon supporters. We are going to cut a check after we get done with this episode on today's conservation organization that we're going to cover. So everything you give to us, we're giving back to nature. So thank you for supporting us through that.
And I just want to give a big shout out to a couple listeners that wrote us raving reviews on Apple iTunes, Moot Dog, and also HDDIG, HDIG, and Burbit, who said just wonderful things about us. And Chris and I do read every review. We take it personally. We love it. It really does help keep us going. And of course, the more ratings we have, 5-star ratings, the better we are in the algorithms of the old internet land. And so if you haven't done a review for us, please do, or give us 5 stars. We'd really appreciate it.
Yeah. And if you could share this on social media, that helps us grow too. That you are helping us continue to grow and spread this message. And when you share stuff on social media, people go, oh, okay, I'll check out that podcast. That's how I find some of my podcasts I listen to. So thank you for doing that. Describing this antelope, I mean, it's got 4 legs.
Yeah, well, they're pretty cute. Yeah, well, we're all familiar with the body style of an antelope, or like a gazelle with long, slender legs. But the churu, or the Tibetan antelope, is not too different. The few unique features that they do have when you physically look at them is that adult males do have long, slender, black, mostly straight horns. The horns do curve forward slightly towards the front, and they can be about 23 inches in length. So they're a good size horn. When you look at them, pretty impressive. And the females, interestingly enough, are hornless, so no horns on the females. And then the coat of the churu varies in color depending on the season, but it can be anywhere from a beige tannish color to a grayish white color, with black markings on the face and the legs. And I'm always a sucker for those high points of the face and or legs being highlighted in black. It's just, I love myself a good bay horse, that coloration pattern. So in the distance, the churu blends in to the plateau of the mountain, because there's really no trees. It's like a steppe. The grass is typically brown a lot. Of course, there's snow for a large portion of the year. So they really kind of blend in, but the black legs, especially in the males, really stand out as far as, just for me, a really attractive feature. And then when you look at their coat, it becomes evident that they have a lot of fur. And so they have long bristle fur as well as warm, silky undercoats. And this under fur is extremely warm, light, and also very, very, very soft. And this wool that they have in their under fur is called the satush, which means king of wool in Persian. And because of its soft nature, and it's been described as like the softest type of wool, it's really light, but high quality, and can make very warm shawls typically, or scarves. So there was a huge, huge, huge demand for it. And unfortunately, it takes like anywhere from 3 to 5 Tibetan antelope to make just like a little tiny scarf. And so you can imagine the numbers just plummeted when the demand spiked for this. Now, since then, once again, there's been put a lot of conservation efforts in place and an anti-poaching movement and all of that. But we'll talk more about that when we get to conservation. But their wool is very, very impressive. And of course, it needs to keep them warm at these high elevations. But other than that, with the Tibetan antelope, the head and nose, once again, is black. But their nose, Chris, did you notice anything about their nose when you looked at them?
When I look at it, I think, I mean, I was going to say the horns remind me of like oryx, which we haven't really covered. Arabian oryx, I know, was on our list because they're very long and
they
sharp
are very
and
long
dangerous,
and slender.
And dangerous they have the looking.
Little. They have like the little ribs in them, the rings or the ribs that go all the way up. Yeah.
Yeah. So that I noticed. And then their nose is not saiga, but weird. Like
there
that.
It is. That's what I was waiting for. Yeah. They have a very, for an antelope species, if you're going to compare it to a typical antelope, the nose on the Tibetan antelope is very bulbous and they have like nasal swellings. And so it's like a big, broad snout with big nostrils. And we're going to talk about why biologists think that they have this, and it has to do a lot with getting breathing, right? Breathing in the very low oxygen plateau where they live. But it's not as big and bulbous as the saiga. They win hands down as the weirdest, most alien type Star Wars fantasy nose out there. And if you haven't checked out that episode that Chris and I covered probably a few years ago now, you've got to do it. Another really cool creature. But then other than that, the ears of the Chiru are short and pointed. The tail is also short and pointed. And it's a very lean and nimble antelope and not very big. Medium size, I would say, it's from an antelope point of view.
Yeah, so when you look at the shoulder, females are much smaller than the males.
Mm-hmm.
About 35 inches, so 3 feet at the shoulder. And then 50 inches for the males, but the males weigh 86 pounds or 40 kilograms. Females, 57 pounds, 26 kilograms.
Yeah, that's orc size, even smaller than Arabian orcs.
I mean, our black lab, he's probably in that big male size. I don't know. He's mad. Yeah, black labs, they put on a lot of weight.
I was gonna say you don't want to say his weight online.
No. He's up there though. He's up there. He's up there at the male weight.
Oh, he just barked. He's like, don't talk about my weight.
Yes.
I feel you, Arlo. I feel you.
We normally cut the dog barking out, but because we were talking about Arlo and my neighbor came to the door and they're on patrol, so they said hi. Yeah, he's a big lab. And yeah, so I mean, I don't know. You've dealt with a lot of antelope, hoofstock.
Hoofstock. Yeah. They're on the smaller side. I mean, I'm used to sables
massive.
So, but the Arabian oryx is a species I worked with, and they were usually about 120, 150 pounds. So,
much bigger.
Much bigger. But horns similar. As far as I was showing my students today in class, is pet an antelope, and they're like, "Are their horns really that sharp? Like, do they come to a point?" And I'm like, yes, they do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they do. Yeah. You don't want them to mess with them. So, but obviously, where the Tibetan antelope live, people aren't really around, so they don't usually encounter people on a daily basis, and they need their horns. The males, we'll talk about that during breeding. They will spar sometimes. And they also need to ward off predators, whether there's bears or wolves or other things like that. So they're an important weapon, that's for sure. But they're stunning. I'm not doing them justice looking at them, but their markings are beautiful. And I just picture or from the Earth Sounds series, just seeing, you know, 40 or 50 of them just across the plateau, just grazing and then running and bellowing. And mm-hmm. yeah, just a really cool creature.
Well, and what was exciting about this podcast too is going to an area of the planet we really haven't covered before, the Tibetan Plateau specifically.
And it's huge.
Yeah, it's massive. And it's where the Tibetan antelope lives. I mean, it's alpine, the steppe, it's cold. You're talking 10,000 to 18,000 feet in elevation. So 3,000 to 5,500 meters, which is really high. I know I've talked about this in a previous podcast, but I remember I was at a conference in Colorado in the mountains, 7,500 feet. And this is what we're going to talk about, how these antelope can live there. But I remember at that high of altitude, the air is so thin that going upstairs was laborious for me. It's not like I work out. I'm not like as good as you were when you were running stairs there in Florida. But, you know, I was somewhat of a fit adult. And, you know, going up and down those stairs was a little bit difficult. So it's interesting, the adaptations. And it does go back to the physiology. So that will be fun when we get to there. But it's flat, open terrain, like Angie said, sparse vegetation in Tibet, which is in China, and then on the border with India. So it's just a beautiful part of the world. And there's so many species in here I want to talk more about, Angie. I mean,
I know, Chris, it really opened my eyes. I'm like, whoa, I really don't know a lot about the area. I think because it is so remote. And for instance, the Churu or the Tibetan antelope, they're not housed in any zoos. I mean, it's not a species. It's just so remote and isolated. And yeah, so when I was reading about some of their potential predators and other creatures that live in that area, it was very eye-opening. And that's why I love doing this podcast and love sharing it with our listeners, because it's not a region we're from. And so it's super fun to highlight it.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've done snow leopard, but you know, they live all throughout the Himalayas. But then I wanted to do the Tibetan fox. That one's come up a few times with me and you. Mm-hmm. Whenever mm-hmm. we go to foxes, we're like, oh, but this one's cool. And it's got such a unique face. So that's probably in our future. The wild yak, that's definitely in our future. The Tibetan blue bear, which is it's a subspecies of brown bear. But the bar-headed goose, I've brought up numerous times. It's yes, the highest flying bird.
You yep. have. To all of our birders out there, Chris has definitely fought for that. And it will get there for sure.
Yeah, we will. There's so many cool species there. It's just such a fun area. The pika that's in Earth Sounds is in there. So check out that episode, because it was so fun to see all the species there. Now, when we come to conservation, why care, like from your standpoint, you know, why should our listeners give a hoot? It's not an owl, but you know, why should they care
yes,
about
Tibetan antelope? Right. If you're not a hoofstock nerd like me, if you don't see hooves and horns and get all excited, you should care about the Tibetan antelope, because they are a critical indicator species of the Tibetan Plateau. And this is a species which will highlight of how they came back basically almost from an extinction. They fought back due to all this poaching for their wool. And they're doing pretty darn good. And now they have to fight climate change. Mm-hmm. And so they're an indicator species in that if they're doing well and they're not changing their migratory patterns and or they're not changing where they give birth. That's a really cool story I'll talk about. They all give birth in this one area, and researchers don't know why. This area is protected now, thanks to the international Chinese government. But in the same instance, there's still a lot we don't know about them. And they will help tell us if that ecosystem is healthy or not, right? They're an herbivore. And so being an herbivore, they help circulate seeds and promote plant growth by obviously recirculating nutrients back into the ground. So they're really important, kind of like landscape engineer as far as what plants are going to make it or not make it. And so researchers are keeping a big eye on that. So I also love this week, Chris, too, when a species is studied and well, conserved, number one, and then also studied to learn more about it so we can help protect them better and help protect the ecosystem they live in better. So that's my main pitch, is an ecosystem engineer and then, of course, an indicator species for climate change. But then also people in that region love the Tibetan antelope. In fact, I didn't realize, but the Tibetan antelope was honored as a mascot for the Beijing 2008 Olympic Games. So,
oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're very well adored there. And that's why the government is working hard, has worked hard for years to bring their numbers back, and continues to reserve a lot of this plateau for them. And of course, and then they're protecting all the species that live in that area as well. So
that's insane. I did not realize. I Googled it. I was like, no, Angie's got that wrong. I didn't mean to fact check you. I rarely fact check you.
Always fact check me. No. Oh, that's Chris. That's why we're scientists. We don't believe. Chris and I don't. Like, people tell me something, I'm like, I got to look that up myself.
Yeah. Okay.
I love you for that.
But I'm like, I mean, obviously, I thought a panda, like, because China's so iconic.
Right?
A red panda.
I know. Mm-hmm.
The Tibetan antelope was the mascot for the Olympic Games, which took place in Beijing in 2008. That is fascinating, because it says Tibetan antelope are fast and agile runners. Wow. And I look at it. It's cute. It's wow. I did not know that. That fact of all the facts today, because I did a lot of my research.
You're welcome.
That blows me away.
But people love them. People love them in that region that they're from. I mean, and they do. And that's the other thing too, is they're very well respected, because they are this creature that has all these adaptations, the wool and the ability to survive in such that harsh climate and be such a fascinating fast runner. So yeah, it's not hard to rally people behind them. The biggest thing is just to stop poachers and the illegal sale of this satouche wool.
Well, and okay, so that's a good segue into what I was going to cover today, talking about the strides China has made in animal conservation.
Mm-hmm.
I know throughout my life, China has always been, you know, finger pointed at, you got to fix this, you got to fix that. Because, you know, and fair enough. I mean, when you talk about pangolins and you talk about rhino horn and you talk about ivory, a lot of that was going into China, but other parts of Asia, not just China. And I would say there's a lot of great news. And being the fact that China even highlighted the Tibetan antelope in the Olympics, you know, 16 years ago, shows their seriousness in protecting their, you know, natural resources and their wildlife.
Absolutely.
I mean, they brought back the giant panda. That has been iconic for them, you know, for many decades. They have helped with a comprehensive ivory ban that has made huge impacts in Africa, where poaching of elephants has gone way down, where now you're getting to the point where, yeah, they're still being poached and ivory is still being sold on the black market, but the demand has gone way down. And now, you know, we're seeing more, it's more human wildlife conflict than anything with African elephants and the peoples there. Some other things that China's doing is they're protecting ecosystems with national parks. They are increasing restrictions on infrastructure construction to, again, protect wildlife habitats and protected areas. They're continuing to ban consumption of wild animals as food. So that, again, when you have a culture for many centuries or decades and the government's, you know, implementing this stuff, it takes time to just kick in. I mean, even in our own backyards, wherever you live, you know, there's wildlife poaching going on and people polluting the environment behind the government's back. But China as a government is pushing increased animal welfare. And then that leads me into what they're doing with the Tibetan antelope. And, you know, this article here that I was reading in Popular Press, massive Tibetan antelope migration, a biodiversity triumph on roof of the world. And China is implementing a lot of protections when, like you said, segments of that population where it used to be 70, 80,000, 100,000 in this one part of Tibet was less than 20,000 in the 1980s and 1990s. China stepped in, established wildlife reserves, and they're helping the animals repopulate. They're doing things like implementing, and you sent me a video on this too on YouTube. It was really good. Highway checkpoints where they will stop traffic and allow the antelope to migrate across the highway. They have no horn policies where you can't honk your horns or anything to protect the animals. They are ensuring the safety of these antelopes. They have wildlife guards around the reserve, so poaching isn't an issue. Rangers out patrolling all the time. And in this one part of China, that population of Tibetan antelope have gone from 20,000 to over 70,000.
Wow.
And then they went from endangered, they were an endangered species, to now near threatened.
Yeah, so, right? That's incredible.
Yeah. And China's recognized that this is this area where the Tibetan antelope live is a sanctuary of life. And there's a lot of rare wildlife up there that they really want to protect. Then they have escort teams. So with the Tibetan antelope, when you're going to talk about their migration, they have teams that migrate with them and ensure they're safe. So when they get to the highways, they go out and stop traffic. And again, protecting them against poaching. So all of this is due to China. China's stepping up to the plate. And it's not just the panda, you know, the Tibetan antelope, like you said. You didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about it until we started doing the research. But China knows all about it. I can't even believe I didn't even notice in the Olympics. It was the mascot.
Yeah, and they've been caring for it and fighting for it and reserving a lot of land. I mean, the amount of acreage or hectares that this Tibetan plateau covers is just crazy. And they're making the national parks and the reserves even bigger. And yeah, it's just, it's like I said, it's a very feel good story. But because of climate change, and of course, there's always still some illegal poaching going on, they're not out of the woods yet. And that's why, yeah, for us as podcasters, I really wanted to bring this story to the public to get more people behind this cool creature. And then, yeah, that's why I had to thank Earth Sounds, that team, for teaching me, right? That's sharing means caring, right? You know, that's what we're here for, just to learn and celebrate these unique, incredible species.
Well, it's interesting reading up against, you know, more in this Olympics as a symbol.
Chris can't get over. He can't get over it, guys.
It's a Tibetan antelope, but it said it was up against the panda, the tiger, one of their endangered monkeys, but it won out because they were putting so much effort into conserving them and conserving this part of the world that they was called forbidden to mankind. Like men, humans can't live up there, and you have this wonderful wildlife and they need to protect it. So, you know, hats off to them. And like I said, when things go wrong or things need to be fixing, you know, we could call out governments and say, hey, you know, you need to work harder. But China has, I think, made the turn, and they're really putting a lot of good focus on wildlife conservation. Probably, you know, every government in this world, where I live, New Zealand, our new government, I don't want to get on my soapbox, but every government in the world can do better. And, you know, we just need to keep pushing them. So, you know, kudos to you, China. Keep it up. Keep protecting those antelope and all your wonderful wildlife. I hope to get there one day to see them.
Well, yes, after watching the Himalayas episode, I'm like, it's on my bucket list. It's such a cool area. And in fact, when I was researching the Tibetan antelope, several tour groups came up across online just to help educate people about if you join this group to go on a tour in this area, what you would see and what to expect, and it just looks really cool.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Beautiful part of the world. All right, going to take a break, and then we're coming back with, you know, go through evolution. There's some cool stuff with them. They're an old species. But then really get into how they survive, you know, this at the top of the world. How do they do it? And how do they run? I couldn't go up like three flights of stairs without gasping. Sorry. At 7,000 feet. How do they book it at 50 miles an hour or at 10,000 feet? So we'll find out here in a minute. So stay tuned.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
All right, welcome back. Get through evolution. And again, if you're really nerding out like me with evolution, you can go back to some back episodes where I kind of go a little bit more in depth, especially early days, because I just always was so fascinating learning about how these animals became what they are today. The order Artiodactyla, one of Angie's favorites, the even-toed ungulates. Every time we cover the species, I always talk about the hippos, the antelope, the deer, giraffes, sheep, goat, cattle, and I always ask this for Angie, and it always takes her a minute to figure it out again.
Oh, goat?
No.
Did you say goats already?
Who is part of this that you would think there's no way there should be an even-toed ungulate because they don't have legs?
Oh, marine mammals, dolphins.
Yeah, dolphins, whales, and porpoise.
I was, to be completely honest, I was actually just looking at a picture of these antelopes, just Googling them. They're so beautiful.
They are beautiful. Yeah, it always gets me. Artiodactyla, even-toed ungulates, mm-hmm. but yet whales, dolphins, and porpoise, 94 species, because they have started on land and they decided to go swimming. And those legs turned into fins and everything. Okay. Then the family's Bovidae.
Maybe you can edit out that goat part.
Maybe the what?
Maybe you can edit out that goat part.
The goat part.
Said,
no way.
Where I was like, goat. Goat, huh? Should I be paying attention right now? But yes. No. I love the evolutionary story. So yeah, keep going. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So family's Bovidae. We've covered plenty of these. 143 species. Bison. African buffalo. Water buffalo. The antelope. The very hairy ones living in the great north.
Muskox.
Yeah, that was a fun one too. Mm-hmm. Check that one out. All right, subfamily caprine. So sheep, goats, goat, antelope, 36 mm-hmm. species.
That's why I was thinking goats, but yeah.
Well, and this is okay. So who's the one in here you'd love the most?
My Tawkins.
Yeah, your Tawkins, easy. Tawkins. Mm-hmm. Angie's favorite, Barbary sheep. I mean, the Arabian tower? T-H-A-R. How do you say that again? That one's very popular at zoos.
It's a tower.
Tower. They're like crazy. They've got like really crazy hair. The uh-huh. ibex. There's tons of ibex we got to cover at some point. I don't know which one. The Nubian, the Iberian, the Alpine, the one that's being chased by the snow leopards and... anyway, the Markhor, that's it. The Markhor is the crazy looking one. I've saw that at the LA Zoo. Shout out to my friends there. So many, Angie. So many cool ones. Mountain goats we did. Snow sheep. Bighorn sheep. Moving on. There's so many. There's 37 species. Then the muskox. Then you get to the Tibetan antelope. It's the only species in the genus Pentalops. And then their species names is Pantholops hodgsoni. So hodgsoni. Anyways, even-toed ungulates, 60 million years ago, dinosaurs went away during the mammalian radiation. That's when they started coming out with little things, small animals, about the size of a rabbit, lanky legs, long tail. Then they became more pig-like 50 million years ago. Then the bovids we think of today, like cattle, really emerged 20, 23 million years ago. And most of them were coming out of Africa. So that molded them. The antelopes emerged about 20 million years ago too. So some are going off to be cows, some are going to be goats and sheep, some are going to be antelope. These are known as goat, sheep, antelope because they're closely related. And when you look at them, antelope as a whole or these caprine, the Tibetan's old. I mean, their closest ancestor dates back 5 million years. So right. This species, 1 million years old, maybe 2 million years old. I mean, they are old. This is an old species that carved out their niche during these periods of ice ages that we've been experiencing the last couple million years. And they've been thriving up there until humans came around.
Thriving. Yeah. I mean, they used to be in the millions across these steppes and plateaus. I mean, and they did great. And then, then humans came in the picture and were like, ooh, your wool is really soft. But they weren't, this is not like the sheep, which I know you're going to talk about towards the end of the podcast and talk about wool. But with domesticated sheep, it's sustainable because they're sheared and they're not killed for their wool. So, it's an interesting plight, right, for to get almost penalized for growing incredible adaptations to stay warm and live up there, and then you get killed for it, But the times are changing though, and when I was researching it, the satouche, the wool, is illegal to sell or to have, and China and most countries. There's only a few, like two places I could find that it can be sold, and they are trying to crack down on that. So. Don't buy it if you're ever around. You probably can't afford it anyways. It's like thousands and thousands of dollars, but it can't be imported to the U.S. anymore, Europe. I mean, most countries are on the same page that this is not a product that they want.
Yeah, CITES treaty is, these animal parts can't be sold. So, I'll talk about wool at the end, sustainable fiber, but, especially when these things, you look at them, I mean, this statistic was surprising. They only lived to be about 8 years old, which isn't much. I mean, that is not a very long lifespan. So from birth to maturity to childbearing years or child producing years to being old and dying, I mean, that's not a long life. I mean, we talk, some of these herbivores can live 20, 30 years, where this antelope's 8. That's pretty young. I mean, that's not very long for an herbivore. I don't know. I can't think of another one that has such a short lifespan. But they're fast.
Talk about that too. It's a short lifespan, but they also have a lot. It's a harsh climate. I mean, and that a lot of the calves don't make it to adulthood. So, and then to like sexual maturity. So it's a tough place to live. That's for sure.
Okay, so talking about a tough place to live, I mean, I just said they're fast, so 50 miles an hour, 70-something kilometers per hour.
I heard up to 80 kilometers, depending on what 80 kilometers, source you're reading.
Mm-hmm. So they're fast. Running at running in cold temperatures, but also at high elevation. How do they do it? So what is the one adaptation? You sent me the article because I read it too. So what is giving them the edge that other species like me, when I'm at 7,000 feet or somewhere else in elevation, I struggle?
Yeah, well, I mean, a few things really stood out. And so in the beginning, I talked about their bulbous nose, that a little bit bigger nose. And so the Tibetan antelope or the churu have air sacs in their nostrils that basically help them breathe and open up their nostrils to dilate and get more air in to help breathe in this, what we call thin air. And so when we say thin air, all that means is that it's lower in oxygen compared to the normal air that we breathe at sea level. So the higher up you go, the less oxygen in the atmosphere, right? Which is why when Chris said when he was in Denver, it was hard for him to go up the stairs without huffing and puffing a little bit because His body's working hard. It needs oxygen for muscles to fire. He's breathing in oxygen, but he's not getting as much bang for his buck with each breath, right? So they try to start from by getting more air into their lungs, right? To try to theoretically get more molecules of oxygen in, even though there are less per cubic inch of air, or however, I'm not sure how you measure air. And then the main magic comes in, and this was so mind-blowing. I said, such fun nerding out, not only to you, but to pretty much anybody who would listen to me in the last couple of days. So I feel bad for my students and my husband and all these people. I'm like, did you know? And they're like, of course we didn't know that. Nobody knows that. But one of the really cool adaptations that only the Tibetan antelope is the only mammalian species on record that has this adaptation that we know about is a different form of hemoglobin. So remember, the hemoglobin is a protein that is on the red blood cells, and hemoglobin has iron in it and some other things. And it has a high attraction for the oxygen molecule, for the O2 molecule. And so each red blood cell, like in humans, has four hemoglobin molecules on it to bind to four different oxygen molecules to bring that to the body wherever it needs it. And then it disassociates, and then carbon dioxide jumps on, and then off it goes. Interestingly enough, I guess I never really thought about it. There's different types of hemoglobin. And most mammals, when they are fetuses, when they are in the womb, they have something called a fetal version of hemoglobin, also known as hemoglobin F or HbF. And this hemoglobin, as an oxygen-carrying protein, it has a higher affinity for oxygen than the adult type of hemoglobin. And researchers and evolutionary biologists speculate that this is because, especially when a fetus is born and then they're exposed to the air, it's a big change to their system, right? Coming from the womb to the air. And so by having the specialized fetal protein that's a little bit more sensitive, not only in the womb to make sure they're getting, because fetuses do get oxygen in the womb from the mother through the umbilical cord. And although they're not breathing the oxygen in, they're getting the oxygen from the mother. And so their body's learning how to use it and using it. And the fetal hemoglobin is just better at its job. And then the fetus is born. And so, for example, in humans, it's estimated that a human baby, when it's born, still has this fetal type of hemoglobin called hemoglobin F for about the first 2 to 4 months of its life. And researchers believe that's just to help it adjust to this harsh climate of breathing in oxygen and living amongst the air that we have now. And then over time, and I don't know if it's an epigenetic switch or whatnot, but over time, the hemoglobin F changes and it becomes adult hemoglobin. That's how it works in all the mammals that have been studied, except for the Tibetan antelope. The Tibetan antelope have a deletion in their 45 kilobase region of the beta globin gene cluster. So take that for what it's worth for all my geneticists out there. They'll know what I'm talking about. But what that does is it causes them to permanently express fetal hemoglobin isoform, which has a higher oxygen affinity than the adult hemoglobin version. So their hemoglobin is doing more work and getting more oxygen, able to have a higher binding affinity to oxygen, get more in, probably at a faster rate they would have than had the adult form. So a really unique adaptation, and the researchers that found this were super stoked about it because, once again, they haven't seen it in any other mammal. So it's really, really incredible, and it helps them be able to breathe in this thin air.
Well, I did some fact checking while you were talking. Busy on my keyboard. No, I was in Keystone, Colorado, and I thought it was 7,500 feet, but it was actually like 9,000 feet. But it was at a conference, and I do remember how thin the atmosphere is. So anybody that lives or has gone skiing, when you get up on the mountain, you can just feel the air is crisper. I mean, it's winter too, usually when you're skiing, but I was there in the summer. Still, it was challenging. And even in my prime, when I was running 5 miles a day.
You are still in your prime, young man. Don't even.
This is back in my early 20s, mid 20s, when I was, when Uncle Sam was telling me to run and run fast. Infantry, yay. But I was running 5 miles a day and I was in the best shape of my life. Even if I went up to elevation like that, it would have been difficult for me because our hemoglobin doesn't carry oxygen like it does the Tibetan antelope that can run 50 miles an hour, which is way faster than I can run, and do it for tens, dozens, upwards of 100 kilometers. They can just book it.
Yeah.
That's insane. Yeah. So, yay, way to go, Tibetan antelope. And it's the only mammal, right? It's the only mammal we know of that can do this.
Yes. And you can fact check that as far as I could find. So yeah, really, really cool, fun stuff. And then I don't need to
fact check you. I got it right here. Biochemical pedomorphosis and genetic assimilation in the hypoxia adaptation of Tibetan antelope, published in Science. And that was just a couple years ago. So
yeah, fun stuff, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And then we got to give a little bit of a shout out to their cardiac system. So another paper, it's a little bit more dated, but just exploring cardiac adaptive mechanisms of the Tibetan antelope at high altitudes. They just found that the hearts of the Tibetan antelope are very well adapted for high altitude hypoxia, as they have higher heart weight ratios, higher cardiac contractibility in hypoxic conditions, and then they have an expression of key genes that regulate cardiac contractibility and cardiac hypertrophy compared to the Tibetan sheep. So they do that better. They, pretty cool. They compared it to another sheep species, and they have, they did it even better. Probably that's why they can run faster and live in that region. So, definitely some heart adaptations to be able to live up there as well. And then switching gears a little bit, talking about the satush or this fur.
The fur.
Yeah, man, the temperatures can plummet to below minus 40 degrees Celsius. So
it's freezing.
Yeah, that's crazy, right? And there can be heavy snowfall as well. And so this fur helps keep them very warm and helps prevent the snow from getting to their skin. There's really, really adapted for this harsh, hospitable climate. And I think that that's why they were the mascot in the Olympics, really, really impressive athletes and survivors, and they're beautiful too as well.
Yeah, no, they are awesome. And when you look at what they eat, I mean, they're a grazer, maybe they're a browser, but there's actually not a lot of information on the diet. You assume scrub brush, and they get whatever nutrients they can. I mean, they're a ruminant, so that means they have a big stomach. They pull all the nutrients out of all that fiber that's in that scrub brush. If you imagine the high altitude plains of Tibet, it's not like the lush plains of Green Mongolia or something like the Chavalsky's horse running around. It is brutally hard up there.
Well, that's all the pictures, like the grass is like brown and it looks like straw, and there's like scrub brush and that's it. And then a lot of times there's snow. And so they have to like dig through the snow to sometimes, find things. And they are a migratory species, so we're going to talk about this. So they do try to follow the better weather, in that they will go higher up into the plateaus in the summertime, right, when it's not quite as cold. And probably there's a little bit more growth of grass and shrubs and things that they can eat, alpine grasses, if you will. And then in the wintertime, they will drop down in elevation a little bit, to, of course, try to find more food and stay warmer. But in general, I think their meals are are hard to find, and they're observed grazing a lot in the morning and the evenings. They do rest a lot throughout the day. That's been observed. I'm wondering if that's just, you know, to conserve energy.
Yeah, probably ruminate and just kind of lay around. And well, I mean, when you look at their predators, the Tibetan wolf, which was interesting, I looked them up. The lynx, we've covered them. Snow leopards. And then Tibetan foxes can prey on young calves. So they are a prey species. So they got to get up and go. But like you said, they do look around. But talking about that migration, you know, how far is it? Where do they go? And then some of these other behaviors.
Yeah, Chris. Well, it's super fascinating. That's also something I learned a lot about is their, the Tibetan antelope's migration, in that they often travel in this harsh, harsh region with not a ton of food and with some gnarly cold weather and winds and things like that, around 400 kilometers between their summer and winter grounds. And when they do this, they basically are once again looking for summer pastures and winter pastures, and trying to be able to eke out as much nutrients as they can in the sparse vegetation that grows in these areas. And the females have a really fascinating special migration where I'll talk a little bit more about it in repro, but when they give birth, the females will congregate together and migrate to a secluded birthing grounds. And they return to the same area every year. And luckily, researchers have noted this, and they've made this area protected, both from poachers, and made it like a national preserved area. And so how they know to do this and why they do this every year, it really fascinates them. They think it's because there's less predators there. And of course, if they stay together more in numbers, there is safety in numbers. And when they get together, this calving ground, it's a really amazing treat. And some of the documentaries that have brought cameras in to these really remote regions and, been able to film some of this, really private, not well known birthing grounds. It's just really incredible. And so, as a hoofstock species, the Tibetan antelope is considered nomadic, migratory, and social, depending on the season. So, how they move and who they move with can vary depending on the sexes, whether it's male or female, and or the seasons. So what we do know about them is, like I said, the females will do this females that are in calf that need to give birth will migrate to a special birthing grounds. That's a female driven movement. But the seasonal movement up and down the mountain, and it's not really up and down the mountain because it's a plateau. So it's more just from one distance to another with some change in elevation, but still always this harsh conditions. That seasonal movement, the herd size can vary. Anywhere from 5 might be hanging out together, mostly females and her offspring, or it can be 100 or 1,000. And back in the day, they would even say in certain grazing areas in the spring and summer, you might look across and see thousands of them. I'm not sure. I don't think the numbers are that high anymore to see that amazing kind of wildebeest migration movement that you think of in Africa. There's not, the numbers aren't that high anymore, but I think historically they used to be. But now different populations can be scattered and have a higher or lower number depending on the group that is migrating. But it's pretty impressive how they find each other too in this kind of remote, just thousands and thousands of square miles, tens of thousands of square miles, in this harsh conditions. But a lot of that has to do with communication. Of course, they have a lot of scent communication that us humans can't fully even understand or comprehend because we have an okay sense of smell, but nothing. We can't smell pheromones and feces or urine, right? Where these antelopes can. But primarily, I think, especially when males are in rut. And so that's when they come into their breeding season where they're very high testosterone. And when they come into rut, they're going to be much more vocal. And that's when the Tibetan antelope, the male, is just known for this just very distinctive, loud, bellowing, guttural grunts, mm-hmm. as Chris said, mm-hmm. horrible singing.
Yeah, I know, these, I know.
These long calls that just travel and echo across the Tibetan plateau, warning other males like, hey, this is my territory. I'm going to secure this group of females. Stay away or we're going to fight. But then also, too, for the females to recognize like, hey, you know, this male has interest in me. So they're definitely the males are extremely vocal at times. But of course, too, the females can communicate with their calves and things like that when there's danger around, if a wolf's after them or something like that. But the call that made it me pause and rewind the Earth Sounds video and take and not only like pause and rewind it and play it over and over, but I actually sent videos to some of my friends. Like, I'm that nerd. I think I sent you a video, I believe.
You did. I did.
I'm just like, I'm just a nerd. That's all I have to say. So thank you to all my friends out there that tolerate me and all my shenanigans. But it's because it was just so fascinating. I just couldn't get over it. And that's going to be what the male, how he communicates that he is the big man on campus. So yeah, really, really, really cool stuff.
Well, and then... So leading, because my question in my mind when I was doing my side of the research was, okay, 8 years, how quickly they reproduce? Because, I mean, the numbers are climbing, which is good. That means it's not like generation interval of elephants is long. You're talking, what, 10, 15 years. This has got to be a lot quicker than that, right?
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, a female, once she's between a year and a half to 2 years, she can throw a calf every year. Their gestation is only about 6 to 7 months, depending on which reference I looked up. But the problem, Chris, and I'll talk about it here in a second, is there's a very high mortality rate among calves. In fact, I think it's something crazy like 50%. So one out of two calves that are thrown that season probably won't make it to adulthood.
Yeah, that's tough.
And that's a crazy statistic. But I mean, in that environment, I get it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, not only is the air thin, but it's cold and they have to migrate. They cover a lot of ground. There's not a lot of food to eat. There are predators there. So yeah, it is that part's pretty daunting. And when you think about a population rebounding after almost being extremely endangered and rebounding, it's going to take a while. And then of course the new threats of climate change and things like that. So that's why they're not out of the woods. But I do just want to back up a little bit and share with everyone what I did find out about their some of their breeding rituals is that the male Tibetan antelope, his rutting season, that's the high testosterone, that's when he's going to be calling, making that loud, lovely, bellowing, singing song to the female and other males to let him know he's the tough guy. That happens in about November and will carry on throughout the winter. And the other cool thing that happens with the male is his coat becomes even whiter. So he matches the snow, and then he has those beautiful black high points on his face and then on his legs, and he's just like a stunning stud. And so it's just really, really interesting that their coat changes color with the high testosterone during rut. And their courtship isn't there's not a ton known about it. It's not – there's nothing major reported in the literature except for of course, some of these vocalizations. And typically the males, even though they have these brilliant horns that are sharp and long, and they don't spar that hard. They typically just try to actually intimidate each other through aggressive displays. And usually that's enough for the more submissive one or the smaller male Churu or Tibetan antelope to back down. So they're not really looking for a fight. They just want to present that they're the tough guy with their vocalizations and by doing some aggressive displays. And then when a male does secure a female, he'll actually typically breed with several females that are in that group or that harem that he won the rights to, if you will. So it can be, he'll breed typically with anywhere from like the 10 or 20 females that are, that are in that group that he won by competing out the other males. And when a female isn't high estrogen and estrus and is accepting the male, he'll approach her and then he does prance around her with his head held high, which that's super cute. And if the female doesn't run, then he'll breed her. So if she runs, then he'll try a different female basically. But typically after breeding, there is no male Churu or Tibetan antelope parent involvement. He goes on his way. There's not a big bond and off he goes to try to breed more females. But, when the female is pregnant, they are what is known as a short day breeder. So they breed in the wintertime and then they only have a gestation period of 6 to 7 months. So then they throw a single calf in the spring, usually in mid-June to early July. We see that in a lot of our sheep antelope species, that similar pattern. You want to throw a calf when the grass is green and the weather is as warm as possible, which once again, that high up, I don't know how green the grass gets or how warm it gets, but it will be better, right? And especially if they migrate to some more of the grazing areas. But that's what's super cool is these females are pregnant and somehow they all get together. Don't ask me how. And they migrate to this birthing ground, which is known to have a lot less wolves and other prey animals. Mm-hmm. And of course, really dense, nutritious food because it's by a lake. And it's in an area, I'm going to probably not say this right, so I apologize to all of our Asian listeners out there, but Zunai Lake in Ho Chi is one of the main birthing grounds. It's highly protected and conserved for the Tibetan antelope where they can calf. And so I love to hear that there's people out there protecting this land, fighting for them, knowing that this is a part of their natural history and that we need to make sure and keep it safe from development, poachers, all sorts of things. And then, of course, being an antelope type animal, when the calf is born, it usually weighs about 3 kilograms. So that's pretty small, mm-hmm. especially Chris and I are used to horses that weigh 40 kilograms at birth, 50 kilograms, depending on the size of the dam. So 3 kilograms, and they stand on their own 2 feet after 15 minutes typically, and then they're ready to go. They're ready to start climbing the steps after about an hour. And typically, young males stay with their mom for about a year, and at that point, they'll leave and maybe join other males in a bachelor group, or they'll just be nomadic. And then the young female Tibetan antelopes typically stay with their mom definitely after the first year, if not longer. And they learn the migratory routes to the calving grounds and how to basically get around and move back and forth. So, and then the young, as I mentioned earlier, their sexual maturity is around 1.5 to 2.5 years. But that's if they make it, and about 50% don't make it.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, the good news is they're, populations are rebounding, like we said, near threatened. The numbers, like you said, upwards of 300,000, some statements. So
yeah,
China's estimates,
Right. Depends on where you look. I saw 70 to 150, and that could be mature breeding where maybe the China number is, including subadults and juveniles. They're taking count and they're looking into it. So that makes my heart warm. Like some of the species mm-hmm. Chris and I cover, it will literally say data deficient. Like we don't know. We haven't looked. There's just not enough data out there. So the fact that there's a couple different numbers, the general consensus seems to be that the population is trending upward, which that's awesome.
Yeah. And I mean, conservation works, right? It works. And I'm going to get to our conservation organization here in a second. I did want to talk about wool because we, like we said, the Tibetan antelope, don't buy it. I don't think anybody listening to this podcast would. But one thing it got me thinking about is wool. And I remember we talked about muskox and the kiviet. I think I'm saying that right.
I think so.
Yeah. It's popular and it's from muskox. Now, some of it is farmed. I remember we talked about that up in Alaska. They are still wild animals, but they do collect it. Another group I found that sell muskox wool online, they collect it off the bushes and the tundra. And so their supply is very limited, but they do have it and they make it wool. Vicuna wool. So we've talked about them before.
Well, that's really interesting because I was reading about the Tibetan antelope and there were people out there that were saying, no, we're not killing them for the satouche. Well, we collect it off of the bushes and branches when they shed, when they blow their winter coat. And other researchers saying like, no, there's no way. It takes too long to collect it. That's not what's happening. They are still being poached. Luckily, not as many because there are so many protections, but
so sheep wool, like you said, is at least taken from domestic sheep.
Exactly. They're sheared. That's their job, right? And they're sheared. They have long lives. Typically.
I think that's the point, is make sure where you're getting your wool, it's ethically collected.
Harvested, absolutely.
Well, and it brings up like, because our polyesters, nylon, polypropylene, a lot of our clothes are made with synthetics that are chemicals derived from crude oil.
I mean, like all of our clothes for the most part.
That's like, supporting wool. And, I'm going to be a little bit more self-conscious when I buy clothes, especially nice sweaters and whatever I can, that it's, either cotton-based or wool. Go back to some of these natural fibers because it's,
there's too much plastics in our environment, in our water, in chemicals, our blood.
Yeah.
I have tile floors, which are wonderful here in Florida and pretty easy to clean with the pets and environmentally friendly and all of that. But of course we do have some rugs and we need to replace them. And I'm looking into actually getting some wool ones because they're the most sustainable and they're not as chemically treated as the rugs that you just buy at a big box store or whatever. There's the amount of chemicals on them are crazy. And that's just to treat them, but then they're actually made of plastic. So it's a crazy time we live in as far as trying to get away from plastics. Yeah. It's hard. It's almost impossible, but I think every little bit counts and voting with your dollar counts. And we always talk about sustainable fashion on this podcast, but I think it's the same way too, as far as trying to get sustainable, but then also reducing plastics where we can.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So this week we're going to come back to the Nature Conservancy. It's looking into a Tibetan antelope organization. There really was nothing. I mean, China, a lot of this is government run, but they are working with World Wildlife Fund. They are working with the Nature Conservancy. Again, this is an excellent organization. We've covered them before. Just really quickly, their goals for 2030, because we are faced with this climate crisis and all the other things that we're facing. So one of the things they want to do is reduce 3 gigatons of carbon dioxide emissions yearly. So planting trees, rehabilitating forests, and things like that. They're working with local agencies. They're conserving nearly 10 billion acres of ocean. So again, going in protecting our aquatic fish and all the things there. Conserve 1.6 billion acres of land. Conserve more than 620,000 miles of river. Support 45 million local stewards. So these are people out in the environment. And like I said, they have projects in China to benefit the Tibetan plains and other areas in China, because China is such a massive country and there's so many incredible species there and different biomes. It's an area of the world I really want to get to one day and see. But the Nature Conservancy, again, check them out, nature.org, and you know, sign up and get on their newsletters, check them out on social media. It's a great organization to support.
Awesome, Chris. Thanks for doing that. Yes, it's a great group.
All right. Well, I learned a lot this week researching the Tibetan antelope. It's an incredible part of the world. Check them out. You want to plug Earth Sounds again?
Yes. And once again, I just have to give a huge shout out to Alex and Sam, the producers of the new Apple TV series, Earth Sounds. Hear our planet like never before. Check it out. It was obviously amazing sounds, beautiful footage. They filmed for over, I think, like 3 to 4 years trying to get some of these sounds and some of these shots to come together. So it's just incredible. I was talking with the gentleman. I'm like, this is like your thesis. I mean, this is just your life's work. It's so incredible. Well done. Fun to watch. And there's, I think it's 12 different episodes. And the boys and I have watched like the first six. We're in love. And the Himalayas episode, the second one, is where I was really inspired to cover the Tibetan antelope. So, but quite frankly, after watching it, Chris, I want to cover more insects. So I'll leave that
there. I know. Okay. Well,
but and birds. Oh my gosh, some of the birds they have on there too are just. I've turned into a total bird nerd. We'll talk more about that in podcasts to come. So, anyways, thanks for listening. Check out Earth Sounds, Apple TV. I talked to both Alex and Sam all about the filming. It's incredible. And thank you for caring and sharing this podcast.
Yeah. Take care.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today. And view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save-